Hello, hello. Welcome once again to Learning Digital Photography. I'm your host, Jason Anderson, and the big subject on this week's show is low-light photography. The question surrounding that is, how low can you go? How low can the ambient light get before you start having to make sacrifices in the quality of your images? What are the sacrifices you have to make when you're shooting in low-light photography? We're going to talk to a photographer that is well-versed in this subject. Her name is Beck Thomas. She shoots in the Washington area. She's got some great fine artwork. She does a lot of photography in low-level light, a lot of fog, a lot of absence of light kind of photos. She's got some remarkable work. So we're going to get some tips and tricks from her to help us answer this question of how low can you go in low-light photography. We're also going to take some listener questions and answers, and of course, we will address a little bit in the photo news. All that's coming up in just a minute, so don't go away. Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. Starting off the news for this week's show, just a couple articles I wanted to share with you that I caught towards the tail end of last week. The first article that came to my attention was this audio sound system that Panasonic came out with. They released this sound system that includes a photo album or a photo display, if you will. They call it the audio system with photo frame, and it's this MW-10. It costs $300. It's basically an audio system with a built-in photo viewer and basically a TV at this point, but it doesn't have all the plugins and it's got limited storage. Apparently you can connect your iPod to it. You can do an iPod. You can do an SD card. You can use the 4 gigs of internal memory. Panasonic says that the device can store up to 6,000 photos with its built-in memory and should keep those musical slideshows running long into the night. So take that for what it's worth. I think it's probably a sign of things to come. I don't know what kind of plugins it has. This article didn't go into a whole lot of details. But like I said, it's just a sign of things to come. And I think you'll just probably start seeing larger ones with more storage and better quality speakers, things of that nature. For $300, though, I would imagine this is pretty good. And it's designed as a photo viewer / audio system. So it's pretty interesting. I can link to this article in Macworld. I would just recommend Googling the product number, Panasonic MW-10. You can get a lot more news articles than the one I'm looking at here. Just kind of hit the photo industry. I thought it was interesting, so I'd mention it here on the show. The second news item of note is the Facebook came out with this photo tagging, and it's an automated feature now over on Facebook.com. So for those of you with Facebook accounts, you can automatically get all the photos on your account tagged, so you can it's easier for you now to find your friends and family. Basically, it takes this face detection technology and is applying it to all your online photos that you share in places like Facebook. I'm sure the other social networking outlets will glom onto this as well. And the whole idea is one where it uses the face detection, so it kind of maps your physical features, if you will, and tries to find other pictures of you across the internet. I'm not sure this is really ready for the prime time in the social community. It just means it's going to be querying a lot of social networking sites, and there's probably going to be a lot of false positives, at least initially. They say it's been in beta since July, but I'm not sure it's really ready there. I could be wrong. I don't use Facebook a lot. I don't know. So maybe this could have some advantages there. If you think there are some advantages, feel free to email or stop into the blog or share your comments over on the podcast. But that was the second item of note for this week's show. The third item that I'm probably going to spend the most time on is this Google article that came out, or Google announcement that came out. They're cutting their prices on their Picasa photo storage. And it just caught my eye because Picasa, for as most of us know, is one of those free photo editors that Google puts out, and it is it offers this photo editing feature free, of course. You know, you can download it, you can edit your photos, it's pretty cool. It's been out for a while now. It's no news about having Picasa out there. But they were also offering online storage options for you. And, of course, they give you like a gigabyte free I think maybe it's 2 gigabytes. Let me check the pricing here, see if I can find a link for you. But yeah, you can get 1 gigabyte free. And if you're interested in upgrading or paying for pricing, you can do that. Paid storage, I don't know what it used to be, but the new pricing scheme is for $5 a year, you can get 20 gigabytes of storage. $20 a year will get you roughly 80 gigabytes of storage, 80 gigs of storage, yeah. $50 will get you 200, and it ratchets up from there. The high-end, top-end, top-tier pricing for as little as $4,096 a year, you can get 16 terabytes. That's right, 16 terabytes of storage. That's pretty huge. I'm not sure I would know many people that would need that kind of storage capacity, and I know a lot of photographers, so I don't know how useful that's going to be. Take that for what you'd like, but if you're interested, you can get that. So that wraps up the news for this week. Just kind of an interesting thing. Like I said, I'll link to that in the show notes. I'm going to take a quick break and come back and give you a little bit of photo tips here, more of the technical side of how to shoot in low-light photography. The reason being is because when Beck Thomas and I sat down and had our conversation, we leaned more towards the creative, and I thought it might help to give at least a little bit of a primer to answer this question of how to shoot in low light. I do hear the music coming up in the background here, though, so I'm going to sign out for just a minute, and I'll be back to talk to you about the technical side of shooting in low light photography. I'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. I hope you're enjoying these little new musical segments that I'm adding in between segments for the podcast. I'd gotten a lot of listener feedback saying they wanted more definite cutoff times that they could find that splits up the segments of the show and something that's a little more upbeat than the stuff that I've had in the past. So I hope you're enjoying those new segments. Briefly, what I'd like to do is take a minute and talk to you about the types of things that you can do to offset low-light photography before I get into the conversation with Beck Thomas, because, like I said in the last segment, we talked more about the creative side, not the technical side. And one of the things that I think that is important to recognize is that when you're shooting in low light, because you really are going to have a much smaller quantity of light, of ambient light in the area. And of course, I am assuming that you're shooting in ambient light and you're not doing flash photography. If you're doing flash photography, it's a whole different set of rules that doesn't really apply to the same degree here in low light photography. But the reason why low light photography is such a challenge is because you have limited light to shoot in. And it's that limited light that you're trying to capture. You're trying to show that low contrast light. So, and if you look at Beck Thomas's photo gallery, she's got shades of gray. So there's not a lot of color here. You're not going to see a lot of color. You're going for more of the muted tones and having that fill the entire gamut of your photo. And you're making the absence of light part of your composition. And the problem that that introduces is because you have less light, you need to compensate with the technical side of things, which means you're going to have to either, and you could be any one of the combination of the three of these things, but you're going to have to consider cranking up your ISO settings, and this is going to cause more noise to be generated inside your pictures, whether it's digital or grain in film. And the second thing you have to consider doing is whether or not you want to open up your shutter, or excuse me, not your shutter, open up your aperture wider to allow more light in. And what that's going to do is that's going to decrease your depth of field. So if you're going for landscape type photography, that might not be much of an option there. So the last option that you have available to you is that of shortening your shutter speed so that you would not be able to effectively hold your camera still and avoid the camera shake or the camera blur. So you have to have really steady hands. And this is one of the things that Beck and I talk about is, you know, what defines the limits of what how slow you can hand hold your camera without introducing blur. And apparently she's quite good at it because she says she shoots almost all of the time with handheld shots. She doesn't use her tripod all that often. If you're still learning how to master the low-light photography scene, I would recommend a tripod. She even mentions her tripod as well. But those are just three of the things that you have to consider and the things you have to balance. And the pros in getting the balance right is that you will have number one, sharp photos. You're gonna have photos that don't have any kind of blur or motion blur in there. Number two, you'll have a wide enough depth of field so that you can your viewers can see throughout the entire frame if that's what you want. And then the last thing, of course, is you're going to avoid the noise that comes with cranking your ISO too high. So there are pros and cons. If you want the noise, then go ahead and crank that ISO. If you want that shallow depth of field, open your aperture wide up. And if you're okay with a little bit of motion blur, that's fine too. These are all things that you need to consider, though, when you're going to go shoot in low light photography. The fine art photography that Beck Thomas has in her gallery is like foggy type areas, overcast areas, rain times when there's a lot of rain. She lives in Washington, so she does get a lot of rain throughout the year, so that is kind of her forte there, and I'll let her speak to that. But there are some other genres of photography where you may be in low light. Band photography is a big one that comes to mind. So that is some of the technical side of the low light photography discussion of how low can you go. Generally, as a rule of thumb for me, when I am shooting with my camera gear, I do not like to handhold when the shutter speed gets lower than the inverse of my lens length. So, for example, if I'm shooting with my 200 millimeter lens, I don't like to handhold below 1/250th of a second. And I generally prefer to go longer than that because my hands aren't very stable. I drink a lot of coffee, so I got a lot of handshake. And for me, I'm just not comfortable getting to the tack sharp photos that I want to get. If I don't want the camera blur, then I'm going to mount it on a tripod. So for me, that is the limit there. It's the inverse. It's a general rule of thumb that most people ascribe to. So I would encourage you to follow that methodology for your own photography as well. As far as the aperture goes, when I'm doing fine art photography, I like things pretty tack sharp. So I want to shoot at f11 or f16, f8 at the minimum, because I really want that larger depth of field that goes with landscape photography. And last but not least, I do like to keep my noise levels down. I don't like a lot of grain. I think there are some times when it can be beneficial in fine art photography, but for the most part, I think many of us prefer to have the smoother, cleaner look that comes with the absence of noise. So for me, a tripod is a definite must when shooting in low light photography. If you're doing band photography, though, lots of luck. You're going to need to learn how to compensate for one or more of those things, either learning how to handhold very slowly, learning how to deal with a shallow depth of field, or learning how to deal with noise, or any combination of the above. So those are some of the technical limitations that you're going to have to deal with. I'd like to switch gears down though now and get over to our discussion with Beck Thomas, because she really had some good insights on the creative side of things, and we just had a lot of fun talking. This is a great discussion. I really want to thank her for stopping in and talking with us here. So without further ado, let me just take a quick little musical outro here, if you will, and we'll come back in just a moment with Beck Thomas. Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. On us to talk about how low can you go this week is Beck Thomas. Beck Thomas is a photographer out of Seattle, Washington. Actually, you're not in Seattle. Where are you? Where are you, Beck?
I am on Canino Island, which is north of Seattle.
Oh, you're north of Seattle. Okay.
But yeah, it's actually really well known because we have some really famous artists here.
Of course, Beck Thomas is one of those famous artists.
I'm not one of the famous ones.
You're getting up there, though, because the photography on your site is really, really good. You've got some great shots.
Thank you.
The reason why we're having you on the show this week is because our theme this week is about low-light photography. And in talking with you on Twitter and through the web and Flickr and whatnot, I noticed that you have a lot of low-light shots, and I thought it would be interesting to bring you on the show and have you talk to us about what you do with your low-light photography, how you take care of your gear, what kind of shots do you look for, ID setup, how do you, you know, prep your gear, that kind of thing. But what's most interesting for me about your work is, how do you like pre-visualize, do you like scout these places, like how do you know that these shots are out there? Because my big problem with low light photography is I can't see to scout it out. So it's like, are you going around to all these places and making notes and saying, okay, come back here? What, you know, what kind of stuff do you do there?
Yeah, actually, I'm a planner. I plan my shots.
A shot planner. One of the
I
shot
am.
pianos. Wow. So, okay, so you're going out and you're doing a lot of scouting, you're checking stuff out, and
Yeah, I try to as much as I can. A lot of my photography is done in fog, and fog is the ultimate in unpredictable.
okay.
So I kind of scout out what I think will work in fog ahead of time.
Cool.
And then if we get some real good fog, then I head out and see if the shots will work out.
Very cool. And you're doing, I noticed you do a lot of black and white, which seems to be very effective, but then I was looking on your color galleries, and you've got some foggy shots in there too that seem like they're pretty cool. Do you like plan between the two? Like, do you go out and you say, okay, this is gonna look good in black and white, and this is gonna look good in color? Or do you just wait until post-production and say, I like it better this way?
Actually, black and white is my main focus,
Okay.
partially due to the fact that in black and white, it really brings out the details. The color itself is a distracting element in any photo, so you miss a lot of items in the composition of a photo just because the color is glaring at you.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I hadn't thought of it that way. Now, do you introduce any selective colors back when you do your black and white photography, or do you just keep it straight black and white? Because I'm seeing a couple in here where it looks like you've got maybe a little greenish kind of light. Like I'm looking at this one flower on, what is it? I think the fourth page of your black and white gallery.
Calandula.
Yeah, that's a really cool shot. But it looks like there's a little hint of green in there. So do you introduce at least subtle color back in, or how do you do that kind
Actually,
of
what
thing?
it's doing, it's doing quad, duo, and tritones.
Oh, sorry. Okay, so you're doing the tones. Okay, very cool.
Yeah,
Very cool.
I do some. I do quite a bit even of just straight grayscale, but some shots I really like to do a little different. So we end up. Green tends to be my favorite off tone range.
And see, that's interesting that you picked the green, and I'm noticing that in a lot of your shots, that same kind of theme throughout, because most people, when they go out and do black and white photography, they'll introduce a little bit of red back in for like a
Yeah,
rustic kind of thing. And I'm seeing, I like how you're going around it with a different tack, if you will. It looks pretty cool like that.
green just really works for me. It might be
Like
because I'm
Kermit the Frog.
surrounded by green, so green is the natural element.
Oh, okay.
In a
Yeah.
lot of these photos, if you
Right.
actually saw them in color, you'd see a lot of green.
Okay. Yeah, and that makes sense being up in that area where you got a lot of trees and a lot of woodland, all that kind of stuff. So that actually makes sense for that. Makes a lot of sense. Wow, you got a really nice waterfall shot on here too, on one of your pages coming down. That's very cool stuff. Now tell me, when you go out and you, like you said, you're planning your shots, do you wait for certain types of fog? Like, is there fog that you won't go out in just because it's too thick, or you won't go out in because there's not enough of it? Like, what do you look for in your foggy shots?
I've never had fog that's too thick. Fog bounces light.
Yeah. Great
So
softbox.
it's a
Fantastic
great
soft.
softbox, yeah.
Fantastic softbox. Then they say clouds and fog are the two best ways to really diffuse your light. So
Yeah,
you definitely.
overcast is the best time to shoot for an average person who doesn't know a lot about photography. They're going to get the best shots in overcast
Right.
if they don't understand the light. Fog just amplifies that.
Right.
It evenly distributes the light, and you're standing right in the cloud.
So you got a softbox not only coming from above you like you're doing in cloud cover, but you
Yeah,
also
you're in
got
it.
light coming from the side, coming from the other side, coming from behind, right in front of you. That's very cool. And I would imagine that can make your lighting tricky if you're using flash. Now, do you use flash when you do your low light
No.
photography here? This is all natural light.
This is all natural light, and flash actually will not work in fog because it will bounce it right back into your lens,
That makes
and you'll
sense.
just end up with glare.
Right, a lot of glare, yeah.
Just like if you're driving in fog and you turn your brights on,
Yeah.
you can't see as well as with your low lights on.
Yeah, and that's why
So it's
they
a
have fog lights, because fog
that's
lights
exactly why.
will point down at the ground instead of straight into the fog, and you can actually see better. So
Yeah,
that's
so
actually a
flash
great
and fog's bad.
that's a great tip for the readers. So for readers and listeners that are listening in right now, if you're shooting out in low light photography levels where you've got fog or a lot of cloud cover, if you've got dew in the air, you generally want to stay away from flash. You're going to have to shoot in ambient light. So in these conditions, given that you're in low light photography and you're not using flash, you probably are using a tripod.
No.
You're not using, you're shooting handheld.
I almost always shoot handheld. There are occasions where I do have to use a tripod, but not terribly often. Oh, dawn and dusk only.
Oh, okay. So this is when you're getting foggy conditions in like regular daylight hours kind of thing.
I don't need a tripod for that.
Cool. And is that when you shoot most of the time, is during regular daylight hours, or do you go out early morning and late in the evening?
The best time for me to shoot is the mid-noon range.
Mid-noon range.
And you know, between 11 and 1 to 2 o'clock.
And that's so funny. That's kind of counterintuitive to what most people think about going out and taking pictures, because in a lot of locations, the noon hours, the midday hours, the light that's overhead is usually so harsh. But for you, what you're looking for is the overhead light that's getting totally diffused by the fog. So
yes.
That's actually the better time. That makes a lot of sense. That's very cool.
Even if it's not foggy, up here in the Pacific Northwest, that's on the west side of the Cascade Mountains, rain 9 months of the year is a pretty common phenomenon.
That's a little bit of rain, I would say. So you get 9 months of rain a year?
Yeah, I mean, it's not straight constant rain most years.
Sure.
We have breaks in between, but we often are cloudy almost all that time.
Wow, that's, man.
So yeah,
that's for some great photo ops for the particular genre that you've got going on here with your fog and low light. That's awesome.
You live in Colorado, so you've seen some good thunderheads before.
Oh yeah. I've seen some. Yeah. I don't think to the same degree that you have it, though. You've got some.
Well, we don't get the thunderheads like the Midwest does, but that dark black cloud cover.
Yeah.
Yeah, that can just blanket us for days at a time.
Wow.
And on page 3 of my black and white gallery, there's one that's called 11607 Storm. And that's a shot taken under the blanket of just pitch black low-lying clouds.
Page 3. Okay. I'm going to the home. Black and white gallery. Page 2, page 3. So which one is this we're talking about?
Middle of the bottom row.
That's a bunch of candles.
You're on the wrong page. Oh, I'm reading my gallery page. I'm a very bad web designer. Go to the next page.
The next page. Well, you know what? While we're doing this, we should probably let the listening audience know where your website is so they can look at your photography. You are at BeckThomasPhotography.com. is the website for Beck Thomas, and you can see her black and white galleries and her color galleries there. See some really inspirational work. You've given me a couple ideas for shots that I want to take, so I'm interested in going out and trying some of this low light stuff myself. So let me ask you a question then. Actually, let's go back to your cloud shot. You said that one page where you had that cloud shot. Is it the middle of the bottom or the bottom right?
Middle bottom.
Middle bottom with your logo in there.
Yeah.
Cool. And what kind of clouds were those?
That was a blanket of black clouds.
Nice.
And they look an awful lot like a thunderhead's clouds, really dark.
Right.
And this was actually taken at high noon.
Hmm.
And it was very, very dark out.
Yeah, I was going to say high noon. That's not a lot of light. Wow. So does that mean if you're going handheld, how do you keep your shutter speeds fast enough to do these kinds of things? Are you pretty much cranking your ISO, or you're dropping your aperture wide open? Because I know the mechanics of it usually will require something to get sacrificed, either depth of field or noise, to keep a fast enough shutter speed.
A part of it is my friend loves to tell me how steady my hands are.
Oh,
I really can hold still.
Gotcha. So how slow do you, instead of how low do you go, how slow do you go?
I, believe it or not, often shoot at ISO 100.
Okay, and your shutter speeds?
That depends on the shot.
On average, how's that?
You know, that can vary widely. I even pull in my EXIF data to go see what I had it shot at, because I change on the fly frequently. I'm constantly using all the settings on my camera, adjusting to meet the conditions I'm working in. I'm often working in pouring rain.
Mm-hmm.
And so that adds another element to the hurry up and get the shot.
Right.
And wipe the lens, set the camera, take the shot. Wipe the lens, set the camera, take the shot.
Oh, wow. So you're actually letting your camera sit out in the rain.
I use some microfiber cloths.
Okay.
I often buy my stuff at REI.
Oh, yeah. For those of you that don't know, we actually had a conversation about this the other day. We found out we're both REI freaks.
I'm an REI junkie.
So fair warning, if we go off on an REI tangent here, we'll get back to Lillet Photography eventually.
I should be sponsored by REI
There you
for how
go.
much of my gear says REI on it when I'm
There you go.
out.
REI, are you listening? You have a possible sponsorship. Go
They
to
say I wear REI Gore-Tex
There you
outer
go.
shell clothing to keep
Right.
dry.
Yeah. Oh, well, that actually answers a pretty good question about how important it is to keep your camera dry. And it is possible, obviously, when you have a lot of elements coming down around you. If you're in wet, dense fog, it's still possible to keep your camera dry, and you're not going to ruin it just by exposing it. It's just a matter of treating your camera quickly enough so that you don't get condensation and moisture going inside.
Yeah, a lot of the cameras nowadays are made with some weatherproofing. They're not waterproof by any means,
Right,
but
right.
getting rain on your camera is not going to kill it.
Yeah, don't worry about that one drop of water and
Yeah,
freaking
it's
out
not going
and
to do it. Just make
finding
sure you
things.
have a towel to clean it up with.
Right. Now,
Um,
I've
I
heard.
actually,
Go
oh,
ahead.
go ahead.
No, go. You go.
Oh, well, I have a
Okay, I'll go.
oh
No,
clip.
you go.
You know those C clips? What are those?
The carabiners?
Carabiner. Yes. I have a carabiner clip that's got a microfiber towel attached to it that
Oh.
hangs on my camera strap.
Yeah, I love carabiners. There's another REI plug for you. If you want a carabiner, go to REI. They got great carabiners there.
Yes, they
Hook them
do.
all over your photo bag. Hook them on your belt. You can hang anything. I think I hung my tripod off my belt on a carabiner on one photo
Oh,
shoot.
yeah, absolutely. In fact, my backpack is, I have about 10 of them on it at any given time.
Wow. 10 carabiners. That's what you should rename your blog, The Carabiner Queen.
Well, I do a lot of hiking in the Cascades,
Cool. Very
which the
cool.
Cascade Mountain Range is actually, it's a harsh mountain range.
Yeah, it's not the easiest place to hike, that's for sure.
No, it's not. And so spending quite a bit of time up there, you learn what kind of gear you're going to need.
Right.
And yeah, carabiners is one of them.
And plus you got the black bears up there, so you got to kind of announce your presence a little bit so they don't get alarmed and run into you accidentally.
Black bears are nothing. It's the cougars.
Oh, the cougars.
The cougars, you
But
know,
see,
sometimes
I'm
they
not a
want
young
to fight.
24-year-old guy. I'm not interested in cougars, and cougars aren't interested in me, so I don't
Well,
have to
then you
deal with
don't
them.
want to come to Washington. We have plenty of them.
Oh, sounds like you got both types
All
of
varieties.
them. Uh-oh. Stay out of Washington. Good note. Good note to self. And I'll tell my wife that too, so she can rest easy. Well, that's cool, and thank you so much for stopping in. Now, I know that you're in a bunch of other places. Like I said, we talk a lot on Twitter, and your handle on Twitter is Beck Thomas Photo. Beck Thomas Photo, and you're on Flickr.
Yep, and I think I'm on Flickr. You can find me as Beck Thomas Photography.
Beck Thomas Photography on Flickr. And do you have any last minute ideas for tips and tricks that other people might be interested in how to take low light pictures? Like you said, the steady hand is obviously.
Steady hands, and if you don't have steady hands, yes, use your tripod. That's what it's for.
Don't leave it in the trunk of your car. Don't leave it hanging on your belt. The
Yeah,
carabiner.
you don't have steady hands. You want to use that tripod.
I said, you might not drink coffee because I drink coffee and I have the stability in my hands of like an earthquake. I can't hold my camera steady to save my life. I'm always on a tripod.
It's a lot of people actually can't. It's not uncommon.
Yeah.
I just, for some reason, I have the steady hands to do it.
That's what.
I've always done it that way. So
So
part of
it's the
it's
way you
practice
know.
makes perfect.
So can you like slow down your heartbeat and slow down your breathing and all that stuff that I hear people talking about?
No, I'm not a Navy SEAL.
All perceptions to the contrary, right?
There are times I may look like a seal on the beach, but no, that black object squatting out there, that's me.
Well, as long as you're not spinning a ball on your nose, I don't think people will get you confused with a seal.
I can guarantee that salt water and cameras don't mix.
Oh, here's another good tip. Okay. This sounds like a story. Is there a story about saltwater and cameras?
Yeah, I killed my last camera via salt water. It was
Oh,
kind of
no.
tragic. Somebody had walked up to me. It was a very stormy day at high tide, and the high tide was pushing the waves in, so it's coming in a lot harder and faster than normal.
Wow.
And somebody came to my land side, and they were actually asking me about my camera equipment. And I was standing on driftwood, but because they distracted me, I wasn't watching the sets. And the sets are what we call how the waves come in. They come in sets. So you track the sets. And it's especially important if you're trying to get wave shots and if you're trying to stay dry. So a big wave came in and hit the driftwood I'm standing on, which was a big log. And there's this picture somewhere in my archives of the last picture my camera took of this big wave coming over the top of us.
Well, did you save the photos off the card?
Yeah, the card was fine.
Cool.
It actually ended up, the saltwater corroded the on-off button first.
How long did that take?
About 2 days.
Oh, so you were still able to use it for at least a little bit of time.
If I left it, I had to leave it in the on position and pop the battery in and out in order to get it to work. But yeah, that's that camera.
That sounds like a little jerry-rigging. You have to leave it in this position and shake it once to the left and shake it once to the right. It's kind of like the camera hokey-pokey.
It really was. I was on the beach cursing like a sailor.
Oh, we never do that in photography. You can't do that in photography. That's not permitted.
Yes, we can when a wave just takes out our camera gear.
Yeah, and I'm sure you thanked the guy that was asking you all the questions. You were probably like, get out of here, freak!
The look on his face was something.
Like, thanks, buddy.
I actually had my kids down there with me, or one of my kids anyway. They were standing back far enough, and they're like, Mom, yeah. You got wet.
It's not me. It's the camera.
I know. So, I'm like, that's not helpful, honey.
Yeah. Just go sit down. Leave me alone. So you said you ruined a camera from salt water. Man, that's
cute. Yes.
Now, which camera was that? Here's the question. Are you a Canon shooter?
I'm not a Canon shooter.
You shoot Pentax.
Sony. I'm the real – nope, I'm the oddball. I'm so far in oddball land that
I like this.
You can't compete with me here.
Kodak.
I shoot Panasonic.
Panasonic.
I use Panasonic.
Wow, that's very interesting. I don't know many people that are – no, but you're shooting with Panasonic SLR, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know their grade system. What are the model numbers that you use? Do you know?
Oh, we're like DMC something.
DMC. Hey, it's like run DMC. It's like the rapper photo. Wow, you're the rapper photo gal. You're the carabiner queen. You're back.
Panasonic doesn't come up with catchy model numbers for their cameras. It's DMC or Z something something something.
Something. Okay, I'll Google that. I'll Google.
It would have been the DSLR from 2 years ago.
Okay.
3 years ago now, something like that.
Well, you know what? In defense, I'm shooting with a Canon 40D, which isn't even in the Canon lineup anymore. So what does that tell you? And it's not like we have sexy names here. We have the 40D, the 5D.
They're easy to remember,
the
though.
The 7D, the 20D.
It's hard to forget the D, though. You always know it's a D.
But you know what the problem is? The problem is with that is when you look at like the Canon side and the Nikon side, they both use the D. It's just one puts it in front, one puts it behind. So it's like the D3. Shit, is that Canon or Nikon?
Yeah, that is a bit confusing.
So I can see
it.
Well,
doesn't matter much anymore. Canon, Nikon, Nikon, Canon.
Yeah. Mac, PC, PC, Mac, chocolate, vanilla, strawberry, take your
pick. Pretty much. I mean, part of the reason I don't shoot Canon is I actually have a reason for it.
You want to be talking about on the Learning Digital Photography show with the Canon?
Well,
we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back in just a minute with another interviewer. I'm kidding. Why don't you shoot Canon? I'm actually interested in hearing this now.
It's actually, if someone who changes settings frequently on the fly, mm-hmm. Canon isn't as great for that.
See, I'm not sure I agree with that. That's interesting.
See, I my dad shoots with Canon. He loves Canon.
Oh, so you come from a family of photographers.
Well, my dad's more of a hobbyist.
Oh,
he just
okay.
likes photography. He doesn't actually shoot it professionally by any means.
So where'd you get your photo bug? That might be another cool question for the listening audience.
Where did I get my what?
The photo bug. Like what got you started in photography?
Oh, well, this is another story.
Uh-oh, we're running out of time, but okay, one more quick story. How'd you get started?
Well, see, I was a young child, and I kept trying to get at my grandmother's camera because it was so fascinating, and she finally broke down and bought me my first Barbie 110 film camera.
Hey, that's a cool
nine.
Was it pink?
It was pink. It had pastel flowers on it. And
wow,
yeah,
very
it's
cool.
Been doing it ever since.
Do you still put the pastel flowers on your camera?
No.
No. So we're back. We're wrapping things up here with Beck Thomas. I heard her phone ringing in the background, so I figured do a quick out, let her get to her phone. She got to her phone call, and we're back. We're finishing things up, and I want to hear this story about the Canon.
About the Canon?
Yeah, you said that you didn't shoot Canon for a reason because you're
dead. Oh, it's – yeah, when – a lot of people, when they're taking quick shots, you know, they're changing their settings
right,
on the fly. I literally am doing it on the fly because I'm usually working in such bad weather.
Okay.
And the Canon buttons and settings, I can't get them to go fast enough because I'm keeping my lens clear. I'm setting the buttons. I'm trying to keep the camera somewhat dry. Also, while setting up my composition of the shot, what it, how I'm framing it, all my elements in there, I'm doing this in a matter of like a couple seconds.
Oh, okay.
When I'm actually shooting.
That's pretty. And I like how you're keeping the camera somewhat dry.
I 2 inches a day, okay? We've got to try to keep it somewhat dry.
I'm just messing with you. And I think that actually speaks to the important thing about shooting with the gear, whichever kind of gear you shoot, whether it's with Pentax, with Sony, with Olympus, with Panasonic, with Canon, with Nikon. The important thing is to know your gear. And if you don't know your gear, if you don't know how to make the adjustments, or if it's not comfortable for you, you need to find another method, because one of the most important things is to know your gear. That's
the Well, actually, the most important thing is to actually get your shot.
Without knowing the gear?
You need to use the right tool to get the shot. And
we're going to have a discussion offline about this.
We live in, think of Ansel Adams. Think of what that poor guy had to go through to get way up into Yosemite to get some of those shots. Yes. I'm feeling for the man.
Yeah.
Nowadays, almost 90% of the cameras on the market are capable of taking a good photo as long as it's within their specifications.
Ooh, you think the camera is capable of taking a good photo?
Just about every camera is nowadays.
Oh, God, see, I got to disagree with you there. I don't think it's the camera that takes the photo.
Well, no, it's the photographer that sets
but,
the shot up.
You said the camera takes the photo. You know what, folks? We're going to wrap things up. We're going to take
God. Some people. Yeah, the photographer sets the photo up, but the camera is capable of taking a shot that's decent within its specifications.
But,
so, yeah, even a camera phone.
Wow.
If you know what you're doing, you can take a good shot with a camera phone.
But see, there's the caveat. You got to know what you're doing.
Well, of course, you always have to know what you're doing.
And that was the point. You got to know what you're doing. The camera's not going to take the shot without you.
Of course not.
Right. So the important thing is to know your gear. You got to know how to use your gear.
You got to know how to use your gear, but the most important thing is still knowing how to set up the
photo. Yeah, agreed. I totally agree with what you're saying there. I think we're probably...
You have to understand how the light works, which is the most important thing of all.
Yes, light. There's a word. There's a Greek word for light. What is that word? Oh, yeah, photo.
Uh-huh.
Photo is Greek for light, and I think we're both coming at it from different angles here. It sounds like what Beck is saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like what you're saying is the important thing is getting the shot. But in order to get the shot, what I'm saying is you do have to have some familiarity with how light works, which includes knowing how your camera works to take in that light. So
consistently take good shots, yes.
Yeah. And consistency and repeatability is another
thing. It is important.
Because if you
once again, many cameras, people get lucky with them.
Yeah. I think the quote I've heard is, every once in a while, a blind squirrel can find a nut.
Funny enough, that seems to happen.
It happens more often than we probably would care to admit with some people and be like, that was luck. That was luck.
Sometimes.
I didn't know what I was doing.
I clicked a button here and pressed a thing over there, and voila.
And people ask me, wow, how'd you get that shot? I'm like, you know what? In all honesty, I got lucky. I was looking the other way. I turned around and went, ooh, and clicked the shutter without even thinking about it. And the camera settings just happened to be still in the right settings. So I just got lucky. I'm the epitome of the blind squirrel when it comes to photography sometimes.
Oh, it's really it's understanding the light.
Yeah.
Especially if you're going to be shooting in various weather conditions, you've got to understand how the light works in those various weather conditions.
Right. And that's actually a good way to bring us back on a point, because the original point of this whole discussion was how to take pictures in low light, which is something you really thrive at. So we wanted to bring you on the show and talk to you a little bit about how you do that. And listen, hey, Beck, it was great talking to you. Thank you for coming on the show. You can find Beck over at her website, which is Beck Thomas Photography. You can find her on Twitter at Beck Thomas Photo. And I was having trouble finding your Flickr, so if you could email that to me after we go out, and I'll put a link to that up on the show notes. And we will get at you on the flip side. Beck, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been a pleasure here as well. We'll probably talk to you soon, and I'll be back in just a minute.
Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much to Beck Thomas for stopping in and talking to us here at Learning Digital Photography. In wrapping things up, I am going to take care of a couple listener questions that I meant to get to in last week's show, and we'll also address a little bit of contest news as well. Our first question comes to us from Ellen right here in Colorado. Ellen writes in, she's got a kid that I guess she's looking to get a camera for Christmas, and she's asking, you know, can you please explain a little bit about the Canon camera line? And she was also looking at the Nikon camera line, and want a little bit more clarification on how much she should be spending and what she should be looking at. Ellen, it's a great question, and it's one that actually is a lot more common than you would think. A lot of people are asking, what kind of camera should I get? With all the different model numbers and all the different price points out there, it's really hard to keep things straight. Since we were talking to Beck Thomas and she was saying that she shoots the Panasonic, I'm not really going to go into all of the price packages and the price points for all the camera lines. That would just take too long, take forever. So I'll cover the two main ones here, the Canon and the Nikon lines, and I'll basically break it down between their two big groups and then the subgroups within each of those and what price points you'll be looking at, because it really is going to be dependent on what kind of budget you have. So starting off, Canon has two lines, their SLR line, which they call the EOS or the EOS line, and then they have their PowerShot line, which is the point-and-shoot. And each of those categories, if you will, has subcategories. So within the EOS or the SLR line, you have entry-level, enthusiast, and professional-grade equipment. And then within the PowerShot, that also has three grades, and Canon breaks those down into the high-end, the performance line, and the easy and fun. And the distinction to be made here is that the SLR, as most of us know, will have a larger sensor, and the PowerShot or the point-and-shoot line will have a much smaller sensor than that. And we talk about our SLRs, for example, as having a 1.6 crop factor. I think it's a 2.1 crop factor with the PowerShot lines, so it's going to have an even smaller sensor. The price point for those, it's going to be dependent on the features. The high-end ones are going to have obviously more features because they're going to be more pricey. You're going to have probably a longer range, a higher megapixel count, more noise handling capability, things of that nature. The performance line is going to be a little more cost-effective. It probably won't have the same megapixel counts, probably won't have as many features, things of that nature. And the Easy Fun line is low cost without too many features built into it. By the numbers, here's roughly what you're looking at for the Canon line. Their SLRs range anywhere from up to $5,000 for the high-end ones and down to $500 for the entry-level SLRs. When you go into the point-and-shoot category, their high-end power shots range from around $500, so about the cost of an SLR, down to $250. And the performance power shots range from around $400 down to $200. So you're going to have a little bit of overlap there. And then the nice and easy ones range from the $200 to the $100 range. So depending on what you are interested in, a couple hundred dollars can get you quite a bit of camera. I would actually recommend going either with a performance power shot, and if you can afford a little more, possibly going with a high-end power shot, because $200 to $250 is pretty cheap for a camera these days, and those power shots are just really, really good. I've got a power shot myself of the Canon line. I've got the AS500, I think. It's actually one that's also been deprecated, but I would recommend if you're just looking to get started, if you're looking to get something for a high school student or something like that, that is just getting started in photography and you want to see if they will take it further to the next level, $200 is a pretty good starting price point to get into the hobby. Over on the Nikon side, it's a same thing in principle. They break it down between SLRs and point and shoots. On Nikon, the SLR, the point and shoot side of the Nikon lineup is the Coolpix, and they also have a similar breakdown with a high grade, a mid grade, and an entry grade. And it looks like they use letter series combinations in their Coolpix line. So the P series is the high grade, the S series is the mid grade, and the L series is the entry grade. When it comes to the prices, in the SLR range line, you're looking at a price range of roughly $3,700 to around $430 to the entry level SLRs. And then one thing I actually noticed about Nikon that was pretty cool is they don't have a lot of overlap in their prices. The Coolpix cameras range from $430, so the most expensive Coolpix is about the same as the least expensive SLR, because the Coolpix ranges, going from the prices I saw at B&H, go as high as $430 and go down to $110. And as a general rule of thumb, the same holds true. The higher the model number, the better the bells and whistles. The more megapixel counts you'll have, the more features you'll have, things of that nature as well. So that's a great question from Alan. Depending on what your budget is really what it comes down to. If anyone does have any recommendations outside the Canon or the Nikon lineups, feel free to make a comment over on the blog. Send me an email and I can post the comment for you. Or if you'd like, you can also chime in on iTunes in the review section or over at Personal Life Media in the digs there for the podcast as well. Thank you to Ellen for your question. Our second one comes to us from Kristen, also here in Colorado. Kristen writes in to ask, man, I'm just having tongue twisters today. She writes in to ask what the difference is between backing up your photos and backing up your Lightroom catalog. And this is a really good question, actually, because the Lightroom catalog is strictly a reference to the edits that you make on your photos, Kristen. It's not backing up anything other than the edits. So this is kind of the distinction between Lightroom and Photoshop to a certain degree, because in Lightroom, you're not really doing anything to the photo itself. It's not a pixel-based editor like Photoshop is. All you're doing is making XML adjustments to a database that will then apply those settings to the photo before it outputs it to print or it outputs it to an online setting or something like that. So it doesn't really touch the photo. And when you're backing up your catalog, what you're doing is you're backing up your edits to that photo. And it's kind of cool, actually, because another thing you'll notice in Lightroom as opposed to Photoshop is when you open it back up, it'll retain all the edits that you have done on your photos in the past, and Photoshop doesn't do that. So that's another distinction to make there as well between Lightroom and Photoshop. Thank you to Kristen for that question. Kind of brings up a good point, too, about backups, because you want to make sure you're backing up your photos. So if you haven't started your backups, I usually do my backups once a week. If you haven't started your backups, start them tonight. And just run a backup once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks, depending on how much you shoot or how much data you have to back up on your own system there. But you need to have backups. The methods that I use, I have a Drobo now that I purchased a couple weeks ago that has about 250 gigs left on it. I got a couple terabyte drives in there, a couple 250s. So that's what I'm using in the PC setup, and that's basically acting as a network area storage, or I should say USB area storage. And then over on the Mac, I am also running Snow Leopard, which has Time Machine built in, and I back that up to another USB drive that plugs in externally, so the Time Machine is running on that. And it's important to back up your photos and back up your data, because if you don't, you could really run into some kind of disaster. So thank you, Kristen, for that question. That also gave a great photo tip. Our last question for this week's show comes to us from Jared. Jared writes in to ask which stock agency he should be using. He's looking at getting into stock, and he sees a lot of options out there. He's wondering if I can make any recommendations. I can make a recommendation, and I would recommend going with one of the bigger ones. The bigger ones tend to have the higher visibility for you. So in the long run, if you're going to make it as a stock photographer, you're going to want to be with one of the big boys. The big ones include Getty, iStock, Adorama, Shutterstock, Corbis, Alame, and Crestock. Now, I did see two other ones out there that I would, three other ones out there that I would also include in my quote-unquote top 10 of stock agencies, Jupiter Images, Fotolia, and IPN Stock. I would also probably lump into a top 10 category. Some other ones that are just below that tier for my perspective include Big Stock and Stock Photo. Those would be the ones that I would look at. I'm sure others will have different perspectives on what they think their top 10 are, things of that nature, but it really is a matter of personal preference. I have used iStock myself. I've actually done a little bit of stock, not to the same degree that others have, of course, but I've done a little bit of stock work. I'm actually kind of doing a little research project with iStock right now. I have an account set up as CBJSON, and I'm going through some analysis here of what gets accepted and what doesn't on a regular basis, so we'll be looking for something on that coming down the road here at Learning Digital Photography. But it was a rather interesting question from Jared, so I thought I would share at least a partial answer here with you today. Thank you to Jared, Kristen, and Ellen for your questions. The last little tidbit I have for you is we're almost to the end of the November giveaway, and there aren't a lot of entries in there yet. So you may have a chance to win a pretty decent prize package. If you stop over to the Learning Digital Photography Flickr group, you will find that there is a theme for this month, which is winter. And in that winter theme for November, you will notice that there are about 10 pictures in there right now, and the winner is going to walk away with some pretty cool prizes. You're going to be getting a $25 gift card from B&H Photo. You're going to get a book from Matthew Bamberg, who we've had on the podcast recently, and we've talked to him, so he's got a nice book that he's contributing for this show. And you've also got an NAPP DVD that's going to be heading your way, the best of Season 11 of Photoshop User TV. So stop over to the blog, or excuse me, stop over to the Flickr group and see if you can find some pictures that will speak to the theme, which is winter for the month of November. You can use archives, so for those of you that might have some archives that are apropos, you can submit your archives. Just try not to make them too old. Don't go back to last year's winter. Try and come up with something for this theme that is relatively recent. You can submit up to 3 photos, so get out there and get creative. That's going to do it for this week's show. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll see you next time at Learning Digital Photography. Happy shooting, everyone, and we'll see you then. Bye.